Welcome to episode number 30 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I am the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
Our guest today, actually for the second time, welcome back to MinMax's Ben Hansen. MinMax recently published the oral history of PopCap Games on YouTube, which is a tremendous, not quite 4 hours. It's a,
like a minute away or something.
3 hour and 59 minute.
Just about 4 hour history of what I think is actually one of history's most important game developers. Ben, welcome back to the Video Game History Hour.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be back. Frank, I don't think you were on last time where we talked about Oregon Trail, so it's nice to podcast with you, man.
Yeah, you too. No, I wasn't around, and in fact, I didn't even watch the video.
Have you, not to derail it out of the gate, but have you checked out the new Oregon Trail on Apple Arcade just for that conversation?
No, should I?
Surprisingly good.
Okay.
Like, they really went for it. Like, I think, you know, probably in the last discussion we're talking, we're like, why isn't somebody just making a modern roguelite version of Oregon Trail? It seems right there. Just make it more simmy. You could have so much more fun. And they really went for it. I think visually it's kind of a mess. Like, the UI is all over the place, but it's basically Oregon Trail as a roguelike with Resident Evil 4 style inventory. And it's like, hey, solid design there. Yeah. It's
yeah. Cool. That is You just did the perfect elevator pitch. Like, that was it. Just there. I'm like, oh yeah, I get it. Done. Here, what do you need? What do you need?
Check it out.
But in the meantime, Ben, what is PopCap? What are we talking about here?
Oh boy, PopCap, the beloved company. I think everybody kind of has the general idea of like, oh, Bejeweled, Peggle, Plants vs. Zombies. I think I got it. But I've been fascinated by this company for so long. I mean, I've been a fan for a long time. I used to listen to the PopCap podcast that Jeff Green hosted.
I did not know that was a thing when you brought that up. And
yeah.
I was like, that was a podcast?
Of course. I mean, you hire Jeff Green, you got to have him make a podcast, right? So I've been fascinated by them for a long time. And so eventually now, in the pandemic, it seemed like a good time to finally try to do something with this story. And so it originally started as wanting to make a documentary. And then it kind of just kept growing and morphing. And eventually what it became, is, I guess what you'd call it, is a podcast documentary, where it's an oral history. So we got a bunch of different folks from across the eras of PopCap to kind of tell their story, intercut them all together, hopefully in a tight story that moves, but also is, you know, a full saga that is a 4 hour journey here. But at a certain point, it's like, well, why trim out 70% of these stories and worry about B-roll? Like, for the sake of history, let's just try and get as much in here as we can without it dragging too much.
I love that. What was your understanding of the story of PopCap going in? Like, did you feel like you had a pretty good hold on the history when you started interviewing these people?
Not really. I mean, okay, there's a lot of different angles. I think the beginning is really interesting and the ending is really interesting. And I'd argue the middle is interesting too. But I think in the beginning, doing research and stuff, I was really fascinated by the early days of Bejeweled. You know, I'm a fan of like Match 3 games, but like those early days were so much more wild than I expected, for the idea that they're just blatant about, yeah, we saw this game called the Colors game online and we kind of just took that idea and then polished it, and that became Bejeweled, which became a juggernaut in the game industry, just a Hall of Famer, I think, literally. And so those early days where it's a lot of them finding designs from other places and polishing them up, I think was fascinating. But maybe you all can shed more light on this. And I don't know how much research you did on your own part, but so Colors game was the game that they said they found online that became Bejeweled.
So, okay. I don't have any insight to offer, unfortunately, despite my excited interrupting of you, but do we even know that's the game? Because like, I'm watching this video, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, let's be clear, the Match 3 genre, right, like one of the biggest success stories in video game history, just huge moment in time, right, for the industry proper, had its origins in some obscure online game that we not only can't locate, but it seems like we're not even sure of the name of it or who made it.
Right. It's so bizarre. But then the weird thing is, I guess historically, it seems like Shariki is a Russian game that was the actual origins of Bejeweled-style gameplay. And if this Colors game existed, whatever it was called, whatever they
saw. It might have been a clone of the game.
Yes, I think it was a clone of Shariki. Yeah, which I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. But it's a fascinating history, and it's all these weird, murky things. And the wild thing is that nobody ever came out of the shadows to say, Bejeweled, that was actually us. Go ahead and give us $1 billion, please.
That's what I thought. I was so happy when you brought that up, because that is so interesting. Like, how come nobody has tried to claim the Match 3 thing before Bejeweled? Why did it take until the 2000s when it finally got successful? Why did no one come out of the woodwork to be like, no, this has existed before the 2000s, guys. Like, this has a long history.
Well, are you talking about things like console Match 3 games?
I just mean that, you know, Ben brought up in the interview, he's like, so no one ever contacted like, hey, no, we invented that first. Give us a cut or whatever. No one did that.
Yeah. And it's weird that PopCap as a studio kind of passed along some of that goodwill where, you know, they took ideas for things like Zuma, stuff like that, and kind of repurposed ideas that were already out there, adding new spin and definitely a PopCap level of polish. But at the same time, they were all surprisingly cool about just like, yeah, you know, Puzzle Quest came along and we said it was cool. Like, we wish we thought of that. And so it's amazing that they weren't as litigious as they probably could have been, you know, further on down the line.
Yeah. And I mean, it was kind of fun watching this because, you know, when Zuma hit big, yeah, I was among the crowd that was, you know, turning my nose up and going, it's just Puzzloop. They just ripped off Puzzloop.
I've been to Japanese arcades and seen this game that no one else
played. Game Boy Color ROM is what I know.
Oh, that's true.
And it was just cool to see, you know, there wasn't any denying it, you know, and it just made sense where they're like, well, no, we, you know, we're young people, tiny studio, just figuring things out as we go. And we're looking at things that like, that were good ideas that are gone now, that are no longer accessible. Like, and it's, you know, it's not like they looked at Puzzloop and said, yes, we'll take this idea from them and take credit. It was just like, no, this was a cool game that doesn't exist anymore. Why keep it dead? Let's just fix it and do our own spin on it.
Yeah. And maybe someday somebody will do that for Plants vs. Zombies. You never know. You know, just keep going forever whenever something is dormant for too long.
Did they have more examples of that other than the Zuma Puzzloop connection? Because they did. There was a quote in there somewhere that was like, yeah, we were trying to find things that were sort of inaccessible and good and see if we could make our own spin on them. But I didn't hear any other examples, I don't
think. That's a good question. I don't remember if they brought up any other specific ones. There's so many weird early PopCap games that I think a lot of those are kind of in that vein. But if none of them really hit big, I felt like they didn't need to go out of their way to clarify.
Sure.
Like, you ripped off that small one too. That didn't really go in there, just so you know.
Well, I mean, I feel like, you know, behind Zuma were like 30 games that history doesn't even remember the names of anymore. Like, PopCap was just kind of throwing stuff at the wall at the time, is my memory anyway. I didn't go back and look, to be fair.
Right, which is why I think it's a fascinating journey of Bejeweled is such a hit out of the gate. It can just fund seemingly forever just this experimental factory where they can try all these different games, and then eventually you get another huge hit, you know, like Peggle that they could jump to, and then Plants vs. Zombies that they could jump to. There's always these juggernauts, but a lot of it is just trial and error and iteration. That's something that came up again and again in the documentary. It's just like, yeah, people see the hits, but they don't see just how much work it was to try and get these off the ground. I mean, Peggle and Plants vs. Zombies were years and years and years in development, and it seemed like they were going nowhere. And then when they released, it just was a perfect zeitgeist moment.
I think it's worth sticking on Bejeweled for a minute because it is pretty interesting development history, right? Because we're in a weird time for games on PC that aren't, you know, big box at Best Buy, right? We're in the early 2000s, and they had it initially as a Java game that was browser embeddable that they were licensing to portals, like whatever Microsoft's, you know, Microsoft Arcade portal thing was in the early 2000s for like $1,000 or $2,000 a month was their business model, right? And it was like, you know, between Microsoft and I don't know, Yahoo and whatever .coms were starting at the time that did games. It's the business model was, we get this out to a couple dozen of them and we'll have a business.
Yeah. And it's wild. Apparently in that time, they tried to sell Bejeweled to Microsoft for $25,000, and Microsoft turned them down. Can you imagine that? I mean, how much money has Bejeweled made since then? Billion, right?
Yeah, crazy. I mean, but this is coming at the sort of dot-com boom, right? Where, you know, the sort of startup web things aren't really working as a business anymore. But, you know, you tell it pretty well in the documentary, or at least your subjects do. You know, how do they sort of turn that around and turn it into more of a premium product and go from there?
Yeah, they kind of gave people a taste with the free browser version. Then, hey, you can get the deluxe version for $20. And enough people were interested in downloading that deluxe version of Bejeweled that it became the core of their business. And they just were able to use that as the base for all of their experiments moving forward. But there's so many weird tidbits in there. Like, they talked about how there were still licensed versions of Bejeweled floating out there with like different skins. Like, they had Tyson Chicken Bejeweled. And I think there was like a Pork Bejeweled. So like these weird contractual obligations still lingering out there for so long after it was already fueling this PopCap empire.
I love that. Just the sheer amount of like IP smearing around that happened with Bejeweled, with Smirnoff Ice and Tyson's Chicken, that sort of thing. I mean, that is really, that's sort of my memory of those years of the internet, is just the skinning of everything popular with big brand deals like that. That's really like, I don't know, very, that colors that time very well, I think.
Yeah. And there's even an interesting bit later on, you know, in terms of reskinning, where I think it was right after they were talking about a bunch of canceled games. God, who was it over there? Anthony Coleman, he told the story about the origins of the game that eventually became Gyromancer, which is something that I hadn't thought of. I don't even know if it was on my radar, you know, 12 years ago or whatever, but that game originated as Final Fantasy Bejeweled. That apparently Square had approached PopCap about making a Final Fantasy Bejeweled. It eventually became this game called Gyromancer, which, yeah, is still available on Steam to mixed reviews if you want to check it out. It's a kind of unremarkable version of Bejeweled with, you know, a lot of lore and nonsense that Square threw in there. But it's just this weird remnant of what kind of was supposed to be a reskinning of Bejeweled even back in 2009.
You know, the Bejeweled reskinning just made me think a lot about, actually, it was the subject of an episode of the Video Game History Hour, Sim Refinery. You know, and it's like, I kind of wonder if the Pork Council version of Bejeweled is going to be someone's Sim Refinery someday. It's like, we have some oral history that said that this game existed. There's a 200 pixel tall, like, thumbnail screenshot on the Internet Archive, but we can't locate the Pork Council Bejeweled. It seems to be lost. I don't know. I'm making this up. I don't know if it's actually lost.
No, but I think that's true. And I think it probably speaks to a larger point where I didn't include it in the documentary, but Jason Capalco, one of the co-founders of PopCap, he was talking just about how, you know, how wild it is that not too many people are interested in this era of game history, kind of that early 2000s, even browser-based, you know, history of gaming is not really talked about, obviously, as much as the, you know, Nintendos of the world and stuff. And so he was happy just to have like another record of that history, just to try and surface that a little bit, because, yeah, like you mentioned, Frank, I mean, PopCap is one of the most influential studios of all time, and we kind of just take it for granted without diving into exactly how that happened and why.
Now, both of you were journalists at the time there. I mean, do you feel like that's sort of a failure of game journalism of the 2000s, that it wasn't covering this sort of stuff with the same enthusiasm that, you know, that it covered the sort of hardcore and the mainstream games?
Well, I'm going to just...
Or mainstream to gamers.
Capalco was one of my first interviews ever, so I was on
it. Okay, all right. But maybe you're exempt from this. You've always been a little bit of an outlier with that. But
well, I mean, it's I don't fault anyone for it not being covered in the traditional gaming press, because, like, I don't think they had the language for it. I mean, you know, something that came up in the video really was that initial feedback that they got from people playing Bejeweled, right? Which is that they played it and the feedback was like, well, this isn't really a game, right? And then they ask, well, how long did you play? And they say 3 hours. And it's like, that says everything right there, right? Like we're still feeling that, I think, with what we, I don't even know if people call it casual games anymore. Like I've been out of the press for so long that I don't even know if that's the term anymore. But, you know, like we still feel that with that kind of games. And you know, things like, I mean, how often do you see comments about things like Candy Crush not being like a real game? Right. And it's so I don't actually fault the enthusiast gaming press for missing this stuff, because it was just not, there wasn't language for it yet. There wasn't any path for covering that stuff. But I don't know. How do you feel, Ben?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm curious, just going back in history, is there a history of whenever there's a lack of language for something, it gets undercovered? I mean, even look back at when Tetris was blowing up big. Do you think the press was hesitant to review Tetris? Because it's like, no. What do you say about it? It's a good game. You should play it. And I feel like Bejeweled is kind of in that vein, isn't it?
No, and it's, well, and that's, I think that's a, that might show the reasoning, which is that Tetris was distributed through traditional means, even prior to Nintendo, right? Like this was Software Toolworks, which is a, you know, what a journalist would consider a real publisher, right? Sending you a boxed copy of this Commodore 64 game, and it's no different than any other game, right? So
part of it is just being sold physically in a box in a thing.
I don't think it's necessarily
game.
That. I mean, I guess it would be at the time, right? But it's just that, like, websites as a delivery for games wasn't, you know, wasn't thought of yet, and probably still not now, actually, as being the same type of game as like a quote unquote real game. Yeah, and I don't need, are there even web games anymore? I don't even know what platform you use. I guess JavaScript at this point, or HTML5, it's sort of a thing still. But like, you know, I think we still feel that. I think we still bucket web games somewhere else.
Yeah, and they talk about that in the documentary, that it was really, I mean, Garth, who's handling PR there for that era, talked about the challenge of getting sites to cover PopCap games. And it wasn't until Peggle came out, where he said that finally he was able to twist enough arms, be like, just give this half an hour, please. I promise you will be satisfied, that they really started to pick up steam. And then, strangely enough, then, you know, Valve got into it. I mean, people at Blizzard got into it. It seems like Peggle just became a lock for the hardcore gaming crowd to be like, okay, this casual game is cool.
And he also talked about how it wasn't just a struggle with game companies or getting game media to cover it. It was also a struggle to get, you know, the places that their other audiences congregated to cover it, like the women's magazines and that sort of thing, is that they would send these outlets like jewel encrusted phones, and they like it, but they're like, you're saying that word video game. I can't.
Well, it's like, you know, they can't get the video game publications to talk about it because they don't think it's a video game, and they can't get the non-video game publications to talk about it because they think it's a video game.
Right, right. Yeah, I love that section where Garth still had a bunch of old press clippings and magazines where he's talking like the early success stories, and one of them was just the most absurd thing where it said like, PopCaps and Sane Aquarium cured my son's autism. Yeah. That's absurd, right? And he's like, no, I don't think so. It seems pretty good. You're just so happy to have that friend.
It was a good story. Yeah. It did well for
it's
us.
It's on the front page.
Yeah, that was definitely a fun thing with the documentary, though. Even just, you know, for the beginning montage, I had B-roll of a bunch of different PopCaps games. And so I went on Steam and just downloaded every PopCap game that they had and played through it. And there were so many that I hadn't played before, including Insane Aquarium, which, you know, is George Fan, the designer of Plants vs. Zombies, his previous effort there. And it's just fantastic. So many of those old PopCap games still hold up surprisingly well. Even something as stupid and silly as Pizza Frenzy. It's like, oh yeah, I'm just capturing B-roll, but it turns out I just want to keep playing this because it's really fun.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they were seen as the godfathers of the casual games industry back when that was like kind of a new products category in the business. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's like, I do feel like this is a neglected part of history that people hopefully are starting to come back around to. But this was a really large category. in like the aughts, right? Like the like 2005 ish, like around that window. You just, I mean, like, well, if Fry's were still around, you could still go to Fry's and like see these games in their CD section, like all like Match 3, right? But things like hidden object games, right? And all of those, like all the sort of Puzz Loop clones, even like this was a really major industry of PC games that were sold to people at retail price that you don't see necessarily reflected on the surviving game portals.
And they're also the only, I mean, maybe not the only, but some of the only PC games that like haven't found a second market worth yet. I mean, none of these games are worth anything. They're still in the like 10 cent bins or whatever. If you, I mean, people shell them for their cases to reuse the jewel cases to put a PlayStation 1 game in or whatever. I mean, that's how little I think even the secondary market part of history is paying attention to them.
Yeah, but it makes sense. I mean, I loved being a kid and walking through that section of the, you know, I guess it was probably a Target or Walmart. I don't know what it would have been in as a kid. And then just seeing these cases, like, what is this game? 1,000 games in one? For my
That's so many games.
I know, but like, it's going to sell like a zillion copies. And I think it carries forward even to today, where you can walk through a Walgreens and they have like, you know, the weird Android things where it's just, hey, here's 60,000 games. Have fun. And they're all nearly unplayable, but I'm sure people buy them.
I think if you went to Target right now, you'd still find some of these casual games on CD-ROM. I think they're still on this weird section near the like the gift card for World of Warcraft or whatever. I think
it's like
still
serving
there.
The same market that still has AOL, like whatever those remaining people are.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, I think the bizarre thing about PopGap, looking at it, and this was one of the fun aspects of doing so many interviews. I don't think I've ever done so many interviews just on one topic before. And there's a lot of benefits to doing that. But it turns out one of them is just like falling in love with this larger storyline that becomes fascinating about the idea of PopGap really being the catalyst for casual games in a huge way. Casual games evolving into free-to-play microtransaction hell. Mm-hmm. And then the weird loop of then trying to ram that format and that pricing into the PopGap pioneering games. And it largely doesn't work. I mean, Bejeweled Blitz, I would say, is a success. I'm sure Plants vs. Zombies 2 has made them a lot of money, but ultimately that weird friction between these two forms is what led to, you know, PopGap's downfall might be a stretch, but certainly a decline in their strength.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I did think that was a really interesting part of just this entire narrative is that you have this company that almost by accident was in the right place at the right time for the emergence of casual games. I mean, tell that story about how they kind of enlighten us a little bit on how they came to be on the iPod and the iPhone and this kind of origins of, you know, what we now think of as the casual gaming market.
Yeah, Matt Johnston, who's our producer over there, he told that story about how it was kind of the, you know, not quite B team, but not exactly the cream of the crop at PopGap. It's like, okay, here's this dedicated group. You're just focused on getting your games and PopGap's games onto different devices. Like I think he mentioned like headrests on airplanes, stuff like that. And then that team was talking to Apple. And it's like, okay, we're making this iPhone or I guess it would have been iPod. I forget exactly which one it was, but it's one of those early Apple products. And then it's like, okay, let's happen to get PopGap games on there. And they got an early version of Bejeweled. And then it wasn't too long before, hey, now you're the coolest person in this studio because you are making so much money. And then that's the future.
Yeah. I mean, I had a friend who, and by the way, like there's an interesting piece of Seattle game dev here too, which is they were in the Seattle area and whole bunch of similar studios kind of started popping up. And I had a friend who worked at one of them. And I remember visiting in like 2006, something like that. And, you know, he's showing me around the studio and he kind of pointed to a corner and he's like, and that's where like the mobile version people are, the Windows, right. Like, you know, the dark sheep of the company are the ones making like the mobile versions of our real games. But that, of course, became the platform, right, for these games after a while.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was a fascinating discussion with so many folks is just talking about how that rise happened, you know, and I feel bad for just kind of repeating some of the questions and discussions we had in the documentary, but I thought that was an interesting idea about just them seeing the rise of Facebook gaming. And I was trying to get a sense of like how many people within PopGap were kind of looking at the rise of Facebook gaming the way that other people were looking at the rise of Bejeweled back in the day, of like, what is this cookie clicker, cow clicker nonsense? Like, why would we ever pay attention to that? And ultimately, they then were rushing to like, oh my gosh, we have to get some sort of Farmville Plants versus Zombies like thing out there right now.
Well, it seemed like they did sort of think of Zynga as not exactly the enemy, but as the like, that's the bad version of what we're doing. That's what we don't, you know, we're about making good games and games that are successful because they're fun and good. And these are the guys who are totally milking it and ruining this casual game space. And then, yeah, then this sort of flip to sort of, oh, crap, that's where the money is now. We have to do that.
Yeah, Zynga was on top of it. And Zynga was definitely in the running for buying PopGap. I mean, it seemed like it really came down to EA versus Zynga. I think Garth says that he thought that Zynga was even offering more money. Nobody else had mentioned that. I'm not sure if that's true. But I mean, in the history of PopGap, so many people were talking about buying them. I mean, Microsoft back in the day was trying to buy them. Sierra apparently was a contender for buying PopGap at a certain point. But then ultimately came down to Zynga versus EA. And they chose EA largely because it seemed a little bit safer and healthier. And I think that was probably the correct call. You know, you could argue whether or not selling at all was the correct call, but between those two, I think that was the right call.
I did appreciate that you spent quite a lot of time in this video just asking, seemed like everybody, about weird prototypes that made it to the that never escaped the cutting room floor.
Yeah. And I don't know if you both know of any footage for some of these games, if it's gotten out there in any way, but maybe just falling into that gap of not enough people care about it. But I thought it was really fascinating. I remember hearing years ago, maybe there's a headline about it, about how PopGap had trademarked the phrase Yeti Train. Yeah. I was like, that's such a name for a game. I want to know what Yeti Train was. I'd always talk to Ben Reeves at Game Informer, like counting down the days till Yeti Train released, and it never saw the light of day. And then they ran down other games. They were working on an RPG, like a tactical RPG called Pop Quest, that apparently was really far along. Yeah. There's a game called When Pigs Fly that had multiple versions out there. Some sort of space game they mentioned. There's also an XBLA platformer.
Yeah.
There's a couple different takes on the Puzzle and Dragons formula, and a survival game, a dinosaur game. Like, there's so many weird bits and pieces that now I guess are just lost to time.
And there are a couple of really big kind of sticking points here with these prototypes being truly lost to time. And that's that the tools that they were using, this, they called it Burrito, which is sort of like their proto Slack / actual tool set for making and building these games, that got totally wiped. And I want to go a little bit deeper on that in a second, but then also that, I mean, everyone's gone pretty much from then. And one of the guys you were talking to said something like, I don't think there's anyone left who would even begin to know how to compile any of this stuff, even if they wanted to, like whatever's left, right. Even if we wanted to port Plants vs. Zombies to Switch or whatever, it's just, I don't think there's anyone left who even knows how to do that.
Isn't that infuriating? I'm sure EA could hire somebody that could still dig up that code because it was back with C++, whereas now they made the transition over to Unity, I believe. But yeah, it's just so infuriating from the outset about how is Plants vs. Zombies 1 not on Switch? I seriously think everybody would buy it. I mean, I'm a scientist, but I think every person on planet Earth would buy Plants vs. Zombies 1 on Switch. And so it's so wild to me that it's not happening. And that was a great bit of insight. The idea that, oh no, it's because nobody who knows how to compile that code is still left at the studio.
Horrifying.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing you run into with companies like this. I mean, oftentimes companies shut down before there's even a chance for this problem to arise, I guess. But you know, you can get far enough along and far enough away from where the company was that there's just simply no one left who knows what to do with their old stuff. And so even if it was archived, quote unquote, correctly, if you don't have anyone who knows what to do with that archive, then it's just a bunch of data sitting there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess some of that old stuff is just thrown away. And they talked about it in the video, but you got to wonder how much of that was connected to just, there is maybe some not so great messaging and stuff happening right in the Burrito system, so let's just nuke it from orbit and call it a day.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably it, right? Like the way they explained it, this Burrito system was not only their means of communication, it was also the repository for code. And that's how things were quote unquote archived, right? They lived on Burrito. So yeah, it's possible Burrito was totally nuked. But I don't know. I just keep thinking about, I think it's true in a lot of cases that the way that we lose this data is not intentional neglect or even nuking it. It's just that people move on. This is an industry with a fairly high turnover rate. And I think in a lot of cases, things were archived, even if it wasn't, you know, up to like, you know, archival standards, things were put somewhere. But over the years, people lost knowledge of like within the company of where that stuff was or even what it was. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, companies sort of like moving offices, there's a closet that has some weird tapes in it and they go, I don't know. And they trash it and that's it.
Yeah.
So
they did say, just to give a glimmer of hope, that Brian, one of the co-founders who didn't want to take part in the video, which was totally fine. But a lot of them mentioned that he was the most interested in the history. And if anybody had backups of any of that stuff, it would be Brian. So we don't know for sure that it doesn't exist. So hopefully somewhere in his house in Argentina, he has just the treasure trove of old PopCap prototypes.
Well, Brian, if you're listening, and I know you are, what's our email here? podcast@gamehistory.org.
Is yeah. that it?
Yeah. podcast@gamehistory.org, my friend.
But also, I mean, just going back to sort of where the game industry was at this period in time and how PopCap was structured at this period in time. I mean, even if Brian has this, I think there is a lot of fear that is very rational that goes into wanting to keep these things close to your chest. Because, I mean, someone mentioned that the general chat was called like Heavy Petting Zoo or something like that. And,
right.
you know, that there was just all kinds of... if you were around the game industry in the 2000s, you know, like the kind of boys humor that was very, very prevalent and, you know, not acceptable today, quite frankly, right? Like things that they would absolutely get raked over the coals for in a modern setting. And so that sort of stuff is, it's sensitive to people, not even if they're no longer with that company, even if it's not, you know, a concern of protecting the IP or protecting, you know, anything to do with the company. It's just, those are, you don't want people reading your personal DMs a lot of times. And that's the thing that sucks when it comes to studying this history is like, there's probably some really good info in there, but it might also be buried among a bunch of like sexist jokes and really bad things that they don't want anyone to see, let alone historians, you know, who are going to, who could put that into the public record, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was, from my perspective, maybe the biggest story to try and work through on my end was I was lining up a lot of these interviews and recording a lot of interviews, and they're really interesting. And then the more interviews I lined up, it was the more people were talking about like, hey, it was cool. It's kind of like a party atmosphere. There's a lot of booze flowing, a lot of money. Like specifically like the holiday parties is where it really started to stand out, where it's like, oh, it was the best thing possible because it was just infinite booze and we all just got a castle. And then they locked the throne in the castle and nothing could go wrong. It was great. And like I was talking to my girlfriend about it. She's like, that sounds like hell on earth, like to be trapped in this male dominated office and just locked in with infinite booze. And so that
you
became
had women you interviewed too. And
oh, yeah. So that is definitely, yes. And so that's what was stressing me out a lot in the production of this was a lot of the women at PopCap that I reached out to, I didn't hear back from. Or they were just difficult to contact. And so it was a lot of talking to everybody that did talk to, but like, do you have any women that you'd recommend? I would love to hear a woman's perspective on all this. And then, yes, eventually we lined up several interviews with women, which was just great to have that perspective. And it kind of just shows, I think, the value of doing so many interviews about this one topic, because we had Ellen on, who's kind of, I forget her exact title, but kind of studio culture was kind of her specialty, right? And so this is Ellen Moret. And she was just great. And, you know, I talked to her about, you know, what it was like when she started way back in the day, what the office culture was like. And she kind of gave me it was interesting. You know, yeah. We had room to grow, but it was good. We eventually got there, that type of thing. And then I think I left this in too, but then when I was like, yeah, I've been hearing about this burrito system and how it was, you know, there were some messages on there that were not helpful for the overall tone of the office. And then she just like lets her guard down, like, oh, let me tell you about this freaking burrito thing. And, like, and that's when she's like, yeah, when I walked into PopCap, I had one foot out the door, is the way she put it, because it was not a welcoming place for women. It's like, okay, thank you. Thank you for finally telling this side of the story. I really appreciate it. But then, you know, at the same time, Rhianna McKeith, I believe is her name, who was over in the Dublin office. She was talking about the parties and unprompted. She's like, I always felt safe there. And she was a young woman working in the game industry. So she's like, I think that at least maybe the Dublin office or maybe PopCap overall at that point was to a point where it had really locked down some rules about, okay, this is okay for the office party and this is not okay. So it was nice to hear her perspective that she always felt safe at those parties.
And I thought it was, there was a good quote, I think it was from John, who said something along the lines of like, you know, we were better than average. So I think we thought we were good because we were better than average for the time. And I just thought that was interesting because they're, you know, in that era, you are starting to have, maybe not starting, I mean, there's always been some women in the game industry, but I feel like more women at a place like PopCap than at several other companies in that period of time. So, you know, from their perspective, they're like, we thought we were good. We've got women here, you know,
right.
We're doing pretty good. We're not hurting anybody at our office parties, at least, you know, according to the people that you interviewed. And so we thought we were good.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was definitely one of the big regrets that came up there towards the end of the discussions was John talking about how he wished he pushed a little bit harder for diversity within PopCap, because certainly the player base was amongst the most diverse in gaming.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do want to go back a little bit to just how you found these people to interview. Because, I mean, there's some obvious ones, right? Like, you're always going to want to interview the founders and that sort of thing. But I really enjoyed the inclusion of Ellen, and now, you know, now I'm hearing you say like, oh, it was almost an accident because I was just trying to find women to include. Is that accurate? Or did you want to have someone who, not an accident, but like, it, she wasn't like, oh, I need the person who is in charge of culture there. I didn't even know that was a job title, for what it's worth. So I don't think I would have thought of that either.
Yeah, definitely. She was like that final missing piece at the end. She was the last interview. And it's like, okay, finally locking into place. That's exactly the discussion that I wanted to include in this. But what was the question?
How do you decide whose story is good to tell in this? Like, how do you,
it's really
who do you want to interview?
Yeah, it's really fun, but kind of tricky. Yeah. So it started out with Jeff Green, who I have known a little bit. I remember at E3 years ago talking to him about how he wanted to do something on the history of PopCap. He's like, oh my God, it's a good idea. Here's who I recommend talking to. And so kind of get started with the founders. And then at that point, it becomes a lot easier to try and reach out to folks and say like, hey, I've two of the three founders agreed to this interview. Are you up for it as well? But then where it becomes tough is when you have to start politely turning down interviews. Cause, you know, I always ask, you know, if you have anybody else you'd recommend, and they're like, oh, you gotta check out these people. And so it eventually gets to that point of like, okay, I think we have management as a perspective covered. I wanted the international office covered a little bit. I'm like, okay, that's great to have that angle. And so it is just trying to zoom out and try and figure out who have we really missed. I was bummed we didn't get George Fan, who's a designer of Plants vs. Zombies. And it seemed like his name came up so much. People really respect just a sense of game design. And so I really wanted to talk to him. That one didn't quite work out, which was a bummer, but we still had a number of different perspectives on Plants vs. Zombies. It's like, okay, there's a part of me that's happy the documentary kind of skews more towards the business of PopCap instead of getting too bogged down into tiny details of Plants vs. Zombies development, which I think the story has kind of been told out there before.
Yeah, and I don't know. I would imagine something you must struggle with a project like this is, you know, you could work on it forever, right? Like, but you're not making the definitive, like, tome, right? You're making a consumable video.
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. And so, yeah, we're always going to be missing out on stories. And even it was really nice when it went live. I got a lot of messages and a lot of, you know, even comments on the YouTube video of people saying like, oh, is that PopCap from this era? And I'm so glad this story got told, or, oh, you're missing out on this story here. And so there are always things that trickle in, but hopefully it's kind of a nice overview. I was also bummed out that EA declined to participate. I was hoping to kind of represent modern PopCap so that the story isn't just too much, well, PopCap's dead and gone. I don't know what's going on there now, whatever. There's still, what, I think 50 or so people working within PopCap. And so we're rooting for them, whatever they're up to in there.
Actually, one of my biggest takeaways from this story is how little they blamed EA.
I know.
I was not expecting that.
I know. I wasn't expecting that either. That was a big surprise for sure. A lot of people had that refrain of, yeah, the biggest misconception about PopCap is that EA destroyed it. Whereas it's a lot murkier than that. And it seems like a big, what people point to specifically is the nature of the deal for the sale, which depended on hitting certain metrics after the sale to make more money for PopCap. And so because of those qualifiers, then there was this rush to make a lot of money around the era of the sale and right after the sale. And that just really hurt office culture and, you know, trying to figure out exactly why that happened is still something I'm a little bit hazy on, despite talking to these folks for so long. But I don't want to, you know, turn this into a college dorm room or anything, but I do think it's really interesting where so much of PopCap is a wild success story, but there's still just this huge push for like, we have to keep growing. We have to make more money. We gotta go public. We have to sell to a larger company. And at a certain point, it's like, why? Like, you guys are making millions and millions and millions of dollars and employing so many talented game developers. Why was there this push to get money? And then this is, I mean, one of the most interesting things to me was everybody was pretty open about the amount of money they made, what they've done with the money. And by and large, it's like, yeah, then we made millions and millions of dollars from the sale. And it's kind of just sitting in our bank account. And it turns out it's tough to spend. And it's like, this is what we were pushing for the entire time.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm totally with you. I'm still very hazy on when that switch flipped, because so much of the early history that you're talking about is like, you know, we were very conservative. I actually felt like they were running PopCap, like kind of how I run my retail business, where it's just like, you don't go into debt. You don't try to grow explosively. You grow it exactly, you know, you just stay conservative and just do what you can with what you have. And then, yeah, at some point, even though they've been in the black for this long, like they've been making money hand over fist this entire time. At some point, they're just like, and now we have to make it even crazier. Like, why? Yeah. What happened? Well,
and I mean, that's obviously what kills PopCap, because, you know, you mentioned in the video, well, you get into Plants vs. Zombies, because of course, and that game was worked on for 4 years before it came out. And that's because up until a certain point, that's just how PopCap operated, right? They had so much Bejeweled money that they could afford to really craft their games, and that's how hits happen, right? It's like you take the time to do it right, and that's just it's, I don't know, it's, I've never run a business other than the Video Game History Foundation, so I don't really know the pains of like scaling that I guess they must have gone through, but it's such a shame watching it through this lens of the narrative that you have in this oral history, that it's like, seems like you had the world here. You know, you could just like happily ride this off into retirement and just make cool stuff.
Yeah. I know. And the best conclusion that I got from people was, well, that's just, you know, they had no choice. That's the industry. That's the market.
No,
I mean, I don't know who you'd have to be to stand up in that boardroom to say, I think we've made enough money, everybody. But at the point in retrospect, that would have been for the best, because, yeah, John, the co-founder, is pretty honest, just talking about like, yeah, the sale, I don't know who it benefited. You know, the customers didn't get more better games. The employees got screwed. A lot of them were laid off. I mean, it's a lose-lose situation in so many fronts.
Yeah, it's very, very bizarre that was just sort of what everyone said was like the inevitable conclusion. I'm like, I don't see how it was inevitable though. This,
well, it's like any business does that, and I don't, yeah. I don't get it.
Yeah, but I love how honest everybody was, you know, with money. Not only the co-founders talking about, here's how we're struggling with our hundreds of millions of dollars trying to find a charity to support that is a good idea, or just, you know, the people that were little bit lower on the food chain, talking about basically exactly how much money they made from the acquisition and how it's kind of broken down for if you've been there for a longer period of time, you got a certain chunk of that. So it's nice that, you know, more people than just the founders profited from that.
Yeah, I'm curious how you got everybody to disclose so much stuff that I've never really seen anyone reveal in an interview before, like how much money they got in an acquisition like that. Is it something about your face? Like what?
I don't think so.
How'd you do that?
Part of it is like, you know, we talked for a long time and then it was edited. And so this is that little chunk. So maybe they're comfortable. But also I think it was just not asking how much money did you make? But I really soft pedaled it by being like, did you make like, I don't know, 50,000? More than 50,000? And a lot of just like that working around the numbers till eventually it was like, yeah, I made $750,000 from that deal. It's like, okay, great. That's exactly what I was wanting to know. So yeah, it's weird in a video game interview to focus much on money, but I thought it was really interesting on that front.
Okay, I have to bring up something very random, but Frank, I think you will appreciate this. You were drinking a lot of bubbly during
you were sipping bubbly as you said that.
Hang on, I just spit take of my bubbly.
Spit take of bubbly. But you were also drinking some aha, and I have a final bubbly count and an aha count. And do you guys both want to guess which one won, bubbly or aha?
Bubbly won.
I'm saying aha won.
Yeah, aha won.
Okay.
But I was really rooting for bubbly because bubbly had an early lead. And the sort of inside baseball of this is, I think, I don't know if this is true or not, but this is the narrative I'm going with in my head. I think we got the entire Game Informer office hooked on bubbly when we were there for 5 weeks.
Interesting. I had never connected it to that, but that requires a lot of explanation on your part.
Well, so we, when we were at Game Informer's office in 2019, we, as you know, Ben, where we were embedded for 5 weeks helping to digitize and archive the collection of like press materials that the magazine had held on to. And we had a group of volunteers. We were usually about six headcount at a time, rotating people. And, you know, we want people to have snacks and drinks and stuff. And Amazon Prime Now was a much bigger thing in 2019 than I think it is now. And in looking for stuff to keep everyone, you know, hydrated and fed and stuff, found the sparkling water brand that I wasn't really aware of at the time, Bubbly. And for some reason on Amazon Prime Now, several of the 12 packs, or at least a couple of them, were
grapefruit.
$1.
I thought it was just grapefruit. Grapefruit Bubbly, it was $1.
12 pack of Bubbly was $1. So when we left, you had a lot of Bubbly left over for the staff.
Well, because we weren't only drinking them, we were also using them to prop up some of our machines.
Yeah, they were basically tripods for the computational system here.
They were tripods for the they were risers for the NIMBY, which was the disc ripping robot, which we had six of, because the NIMBY is really only supposed to like rip 20 discs at a time and eject them. We wanted to do like 100 at a time because that's just how much work there was to do. So yeah, we made bubbly risers for the disc robots. But anyway,
and then you introduced sparkling water to the state of Minnesota, and we all thank you.
Yeah, that's exactly where we're going with this.
You're totally right. I think I always have to have a bubbly next to me. I think it's like a nervous tic at this point. Like whenever I'm podcasting or doing an interview or something, I just need something to mess around with. And so chugging sparkling water, hey, that's my brand. You got to check out my Twitter bio. I love sparkling. No, but it feels, I'm embarrassed that it comes through so clearly as being a big component of my life.
The bubbly count was 3. The aha count was 4. So
wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's reasonable.
I think you did maybe 8 or 9 interviews, because there were a couple where I kept looking. I'm like, he hasn't drank anything in this one yet. Maybe he's not drinking.
He must have been really compelled by this person.
Yeah. Riveted. I don't even need to sip. But thanks for watching the documentary, y'all. Appreciate it. So closely at that, my God.
Yeah, very close. Well, you know, I saw 2 bubblies within the first like 5 minutes, and I was like, okay, I'm tracking this. This is, I got a bubbly count going.
I didn't include it at the very end because it was too depressing to include. But I talked to Jason, one of the co-founders then of PopCap, about kind of his life after PopCap a fair amount. And he had released, oh, I'm sorry, I forget the name of it, but he released a new Match 3 just like within the last couple of years that's very much a spiritual successor to Bejeweled Blitz. I forget what the skin, it might even have like a fruit skin, which was the original vision for Bejeweled. Anyways, it was a real bummer because I asked him about like, hey, how'd that do? That's kind of cool going back to your roots. And then he's like, yeah, it turns out we thought with a small indie team, we could make a Match 3, but it turns out, yeah, puzzle games and Match 3s, it's no place for indie games or indie teams this day and age. It's like, it's just such a bump that this person who has revolutionized casual games then tries to go back to the well and realizes, oh yeah, our pathway into the industry is sealed shut for smaller teams to try and get in that way. But I mean, at the same time, I mean, you look at something like Threes, you know, I guess Asher kind of got in that way. There are still success stories that are PopCap-ish.
Well, wasn't Threes like 8 years ago at this point?
I guess that's true.
Yeah, there might have still been pathways in like 2012, 2013.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think, what was the last casual game do you think that really blew up in a novel way, kind of a PopCapian way?
Well, I mean, I was going to, this doesn't count, but Pokemon Go is the last enormous one.
Well, it's not in the same.
Sure. Okay.
I guess.
I don't know that I think that of that in the same way, though.
Why?
Because it's not, you can't just like be in line at the grocery store and quickly fire up a round of Among Us. It's a social game that requires, you know, intention to play.
It feels hardcore, even if it's pretty easy to play. I don't know.
A lot of people can play it, but it requires intention to play. And I don't think a lot of PopCap games really require.
I disagree. Because if we're talking about the success that built them, we're talking about a time when people are sitting down at their computers and installing Bejeweled the executable and playing them as a game on their computer for, you know, hour plus sessions.
Sure. But that's not what it evolved into. And that's not where the industry's at anymore.
But we're talking about like the success story that builds a studio, right?
Okay.
Like,
so once there's a version of Among Us or the studio that made Among Us makes a game that I can like play while I'm waiting for the bus or something.
You're looking for like Among Us Blitzed.
Yeah, Among Us Blitzed, exactly.
Now that's the future of gaming.
I don't know. I don't know. It is an interesting question, though. It's like, well, I mean, I don't even know what a casual or indie game is at this point. It all mashes together for me. I feel like there's small game and there's huge game, and that's about it right now, although that's getting a little better. So I don't even know how to make that analogous comparison anymore to what PopCap was, because it was just such a specific time where that could happen. I mean, I like even Plants vs. Zombies, I just think was right at the cusp of like what you might now historically call sort of an indie game movement, right? Like Plants vs. Zombies was, you know, just a few months after like Castle Crashers, right? Like this is sort of the beginning of indies being like a marketable term, even, right? Like I feel like it sort of got swept up in that wave, and I'm not saying that there's nothing like that now. I just think it's probably impossible to even recognize what the next version of that is right now.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But I think it's Among Us.
So before we let you go, I do want to ask one more question, which is just, how much did you cut out of this interview? How long were all of your your interviews to make the condensed version, a 4-hour version?
Right. So you want the Snyder cut?
Yeah, I do. I want the Snyder cut of the already 4-hour.
Well, the Snyder cut is 4 hours. Yeah. So this is something beyond Snyder.
It's the Hansen cut.
Yeah, that's right. I think ultimately it was, and I'm sure for people that have filmed other documentaries, this is chump change, but I think it was like 11 and a half hours of interviews total. Something like that whittled down to this.
Yeah, that's not bad, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, that feels like you didn't cut much, if that's the case. So
yeah,
that's kind of
seriously.
Awesome.
Seriously. your interviews must have been fantastic if the final product is...
Yeah, they were fun. They were good overall. Yeah, and it just took a little organization when editing, a lot of keeping track and trying to sort through all this stuff. But I got to say, when you're making a podcast documentary, you don't have to worry about B-roll or music underneath for most of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Real piece of cake. The running time is big, yes, but like compared to trying to make a very tightly polished 20 minutes, it's like, oh, this is, I can do this all day.
Yeah, I guess typically, I guess this video is probably like what you do as a first pass on sort of a real documentary, yes. Right? Just like arrange the footage. And then, like,
you just call this not a real documentary.
I don't call it a real documentary. It's a oral history, Kelsey, whatever that means. Sure. Yeah. It's, I mean, we would call this the selects phase, right? And then, even there's, I mean, jump cuts in here and stuff. I feel bad because I felt like this is such a weird, sloppy thing going out there. I think the story is compelling. And so, hopefully, the format and the medium people aren't too turned off by. Not one comment. I didn't see one comment about people being like, what's with the jump cuts? Why isn't there B-roll? Why isn't there music? I think people are just happy to have the story out there. So that's, it's nice to see.
Yeah. And I mean, for what it's worth, I listened to the first 30 minutes as a podcast. I just listened to it in my car and it was basically this. I mean, I got pretty much the same thing out of it and it was great. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think it definitely works best as a podcast.
God, I don't want to go down this path, but it is interesting how we're still continuing to figure out what parts of media are not necessary.
Yes. <You
know>? Like, I don't think people actually need very much. You know, I think they're just fine. Well, I mean, like, talking head YouTube is such a popular entertainment category, right? That, I feel like we're just kind of still figuring this out. And I just kind of excited to see how this evolves, you know, like how simple things can be and still be effective.
Absolutely. I'm totally with you. I mean, it feels very much like, you know, the late night shows during the pandemic, realizing like, oh, we don't really need an audience. I think last week tonight's better without an audience. I hope they keep this rolling. And so it's somewhere in that vein of realizing, okay, this format gets the story across and it gets a lot of info out there. Maybe it is the best way to tell these stories. Maybe there's a home for kind of this long form podcast style oral history of a studio or a single game. Because I mean, if I was trimming this down into a standard documentary, we'd lose, so much of the story that sometimes maybe it's not worth it. Or maybe I'm just lazy. You tell me.
I don't think music and B-roll would have gotten you more YouTube videos, YouTube views, excuse me.
I agree. I completely agree.
Well, and also, I mean, especially in a situation like this where, I mean, you didn't go to PopCap with a camera and shoot B-roll that might have been, like, impactful. So, I mean, what does layering the games over this really get you, you know? I mean,
people know what Bejeweled looks like, and even if they don't, it's interesting to look at for maybe 2 minutes.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I mean, the most B-roll I think that would have been helpful to this, absent, you know, having footage from inside of PopCap during these years or whatever, is having 30 seconds of gameplay from each of these games, so people don't have to pull up a second YouTube video if they for some reason haven't played or seen Bejeweled, you know.
Right,
but that's it.
Yeah, so it's a weird format where it's like, yeah, we'll use those B-roll clips for, you know, pullouts on social, for Twitter embed, stuff like that. But other than that, I don't know, this is too much probably about the video itself and not the content. But yeah, I think it's a fascinating discussion.
Yeah, that's part of what we do here though, is
we talk process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the word. Yeah, thank you.
Well, Ben. Yeah.
You go ahead. Sorry,
okay. I do the outro.
My bad.
Ben, it's been a pleasure having you back on the Video Game History Hour. Where can people find you and MinMax on the internet?
So we're a Patreon, but Games Friends are getting better. You can go to patreon.com/minmax with 2 N's if you want to support us. We appreciate it. Otherwise, just check out our YouTube channel. So it's youtube.com/minmaxshow. Or you can check out the MinMax Show podcast, kind of our flagship podcast, which Kelsey has been on a couple times, maybe just once, but she was just on once. Recently. Trivia Tower. She was a co-host on Trivia Tower, which is our big community trivia show that we have every single month, where everybody who supports any tier on Patreon, you can compete in video game trivia to win game codes and Astro A50 headset. It's a very fun time, and it's all taking place through the Discord. And so it's the successor to 1 vs. 100, Frank, where it's just a lot of people and kind of this ultimate battle royale to whittle it down to whoever can climb to the top of the trivia tower. And Kelsey learned that it's very stressful giving prompts because it's
chaos.
It's very fun. But yeah, on our YouTube channel, we've had a lot of interviews, I mean, for the last year or so, but a couple recently, I think might be interesting to folks, where we got to interview Masato Kato, the writer for Chrono Trigger, writer and director for Chrono Cross, wrote for Final Fantasy VII, Xenogears. But as far as I can tell, it was his first video interview with the English press.
Wow. So
happy to line that up. And it was fun to talk to him. And it's the classic situation of just this older Japanese developer not really being in touch with this groundswell of love and fandom out there. It's like, I was just assuming he was sick to death about talking about Chrono Trigger, but then in every corner of the interview, he's like, oh yeah, no one's ever really asked me this stuff before. And it never really comes up. And it's like, how are people not stopping you on the street asking about Chrono Trigger? It's just absurd. But then we also interviewed Sakaguchi recently, talking about his new game, Fantasia, but then also, you know, Final Fantasy stuff. And there's some good geeky Final Fantasy development stuff in there where he talks about developing a network within Square back in the early 90s on Apple computers. And he said it was primarily like a messaging system, but he talked about like how it really opened up the developers to communicate in a new way when they were developing Final Fantasy 3 and 4, which is like a weird little bit of Apple Final Fantasy history that geeks like us, I would assume, would find interesting. So you can check that out on our YouTube channel.
Yeah, please do go check that out. I consider Ben's interviews as being particularly good at mining for obscure, interesting factoids like that. Like, I think that's a particular skill of Ben's. So I know if you're listening to the show, you're into that. So go check him out. Ben, thank you so much again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Love the show.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.